The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Friday is already upon us. We're at the last radio program of the week. There's more to come, though, on KPCG. As most of you know, Trumpet Hour is later on today, toward the end of the day in Oklahoma. So be looking for that to get the rundown of everything that's been going on in the world. Lots going on in the world, lots going on in the church, lots going on here on the Edstone campus with PYC. I think the PYC in Edmond is coming up to its final weekend, so all of the end of camp festivities going on in Oklahoma. My family's out there, by the way. I got a text this morning, so they made it safe and sound and are excited to see the last bit of camp there in America, and then to prepare for the big musical coming up. Forget the date, August 12th maybe it is. It's on a Sunday. But that'll be exciting to have that in God's house once again, particularly with the exhibit having been there all through the summer. And as I mentioned the other day, we'll now be there through the feast and we'll now be there through January, even the ministerial conference coming up at the end of the year. So quite exciting. Always a lot going on in the work. And as I said, a lot in the world as well. The President of the United States yesterday, he was, I think, in Illinois. Big news conferences and big turnout there as he reopened a steel plant, I believe it was. And then I believe the GDP numbers are supposed to come out today, and some are saying that it's expected to top 4%. And I don't think President Obama had it go above 3% during his 8 years in office. So President Trump, in a lot of ways, is riding high, certainly when you look at the economic numbers. And this is giving the United States somewhat of a boost, as I discussed yesterday, and also the work. My father even commented on this, I think, within 2 weeks of the election back in 2016. Those that were looking upon that election of a businessman as a great success for America. He did say, my father did, that there would be some improvement for a short time, but that it would not last. It's just temporary, and I would encourage you to go back and listen to yesterday's show. That's posted at thetrumpet.com as well. We talked about Jeroboam and the point of no return. So we went through some important history from the past 10 years or so on yesterday's show. Well, as I say, the president makes his way back into the White House, and he's greeted this morning with all the news about the ongoing investigation. Robert Mueller, now this is front page news at the New York Times. Robert Mueller is now sifting through the president's tweets to try to find evidence of obstruction of justice. So now they're looking at my tweets. This is what the president tweeted this morning. So now they're looking at my tweets along with 53 million other people. We might could get a job with the Mueller probe. 53 million people, as if there is any nefarious activity going on, that the president would be quick to tweet about it. But this is where they are in the investigation, and this is front page news at the New York Times. It says here, several of the remarks, well, let me back up. This is the New York Times this morning. The special counsel, Robert Mueller, is scrutinizing tweets and negative statements from the president about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the former FBI Director James B. Comey, according to three people briefed on the matter. Critical tweets or statements aimed at Comey or Jeff Sessions. The New York Times says several of the remarks came as Mr. Trump was also privately pressuring the men, both key witnesses in the inquiry, about the investigation. And Mr. Mueller is examining whether the actions add up to attempts to obstruct the investigation by both intimidating witnesses and pressuring senior law enforcement officials to tamp down the inquiry. So he's intimidating, and that's obstruction. But this, I thought this was the key quote here. Listen to this to see just how desperate they are. It says, privately, some of the lawyers have expressed concern that Mr. Mueller will stitch together several episodes, encounters, and pieces of evidence like the tweets to build a case that the president embarked on a broad effort to interfere with the investigation. It says here, prosecutors who lack one slam dunk piece of evidence in obstruction cases often search for a larger pattern of behavior, legal experts said. This is the New York Times basically saying that they don't have anything. And so they're searching through tweets along with 53 million Americans. And they're not going to stop, are they? They're not going to stop until American cities are going up in flames. That's where that this is leading. They want civil war. I mean, they're calling for it, some of them. Maxine Waters is calling for people to take to the streets screaming because Donald Trump is so dangerous. And she's in Congress. And she's, of course, probably the most extreme among them. But she thinks Donald Trump is dangerous as she calls for Americans to take to the streets screaming, she says. There was a story yesterday, or at least Richard gave it to me yesterday. America's next civil war will be worse than our last. It's a fascinating piece. It's written by a historian. We'd do well to study into some of this history. What led up to and what happened during the Civil War of the late 1800s, the 1860s. This author, I think I have his name further on, it's down here somewhere. In any event, it was at the American Spectator, and he's writing about this Union captain, George Armstrong Custer, and how that he met together with a Confederate captain, John Gimlet Lee, in Williamsburg. This was in 1862. The war's going on, and they met together in Williamsburg because they had a family member, or they were connected by this wedding. And so here you have this wedding, and you've got the Union officer who's dressed in blue, and then the Confederate guy, he's dressed in gray. And they were celebrating together at the wedding, singing songs. The article says that Custer was flirting with some of the women there, the southern women. He was a northern general or captain. And just talking about how that in those days, as bitter and as divisive as it was, in those days, I mean, when the war stopped or the fighting stopped, I mean, a lot of these people, they had strong ties. The Spectator says such gallantry seems unthinkable today when members of the Trump administration are hounded from restaurants and theaters and Confederate officers like John Lee, if they are remembered at all, are considered precursors of the German National Socialists and their once famous and respected commanders like Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and Jeb Stuart have their statues toppled and banished from public squares. Their names stripped from public schools, and their memories spat upon and disgraced. What a difference. I mean, when you look at the casualty count coming from that Civil War in the 1860s, America's next Civil War is going to be a lot worse, and we know this because of Bible prophecy. Ezekiel 4 and 5, we'll come to that in just a bit. But listen to this. Spectator says, the difference between the America of today and the America of what seems like just yesterday is that we once had a common culture. As recently as 1990, Ken Burns could make a Civil War documentary for PBS and let historian Shelby Foote wax eloquent on the martial prowess of Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest. Something that now would likely get them both tarred, feathered, and Twitter banned. Well, you can't talk about a Confederate general like they did in this PBS special from 1990? Just one generation ago, that's all. And look at where we are today. This historian says, yes, there were big differences between the North and South a century and a half ago. The South was a slaveholding, free-trading, libertarian-leaning, conservative Christian, agricultural, aristocratic Sparta, while the North was a commercial, industrial, protectionist, transcendentalist, social gospel, democratic Athens. But they held far more in common than separated them. Because, beginning, he says, with the fact that, as Lincoln observed, both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God. That's from Lincoln's second inaugural. He talked about the sharp dispute between the two sides, President Lincoln did. But he also brought out their common interests. He also emphasized the ties that bound them together. My father gave a program back in 2011, A House Divided. We've referred to it often over the years and, of course, have referred to the scriptures that he quoted in that program from the Gospels, where Jesus said, a house divided cannot stand. Well, here's a bit of that history that this Spectator piece encourages us to go back and learn something from. This is from that 2011 program, clip 6.
But Lincoln actually brought about the uniting of his country, but he did it by putting his country first before politics, before his party, or before himself. Now that is character you don't see in politics today very much at all.
You just don't see it. I mean, if that was true in 2011, seems like yesterday, like that article brings out. And yet, look at where we are today. People are urging. They're urging Americans to take to the streets, to scream and shout, to kick Republicans out of restaurants, if need be. You're not welcome here. We don't have anything in common. We don't have anything that ties us together. My father said in that same program that he believed that we're more divided than they were even in the days of Abraham Lincoln. And that's basically what this Spectator piece is pointing out. The animus, the hatred, it's building toward violence. He says in the Spectator that the war in the 1860s, it was fought over a single legal issue, basically, whether states could leave the Union. And, of course, Lincoln came along and fought to preserve the Union, to keep all the states together. But aside from that separate, or rather that singular legal issue, as the Spectator notes, one need only compare the Confederate Constitution to the United States Constitution to see that the former bears a striking resemblance to the latter. Okay, so there was a great divide over the issue of slavery. But the Southern states wanted to secede, and then they drew up this Constitution that was basically like the U.S. Constitution. Same kind of language, he says, and far from being a national socialist charter, the Confederate Constitution puts even more restraints on federal power and limits the president to 1 6-year term. He says the Great Seal of the Confederacy bears the image of George Washington. The North and the South venerated the Founding Fathers. Both of them, both sides, they shared the same language. They shared the same religion. And they shared the same, as the article says here, the same general stock. Most of all, to quote again, it says, they shared what Jeff Sessions was recently rebuked for calling an Anglo-American heritage of liberty under law, stretching from the mists of medieval England, even before Magna Carta, to our own Bill of Rights. Well, and then the article goes on and points out, it's by H.W. Crocker, by the way. That's the historian. He goes on to talk about the deep divisions that are ripping America apart today. And again, this is something that my father has addressed on the Key of David over the years. This statement here is from a 2015 program. It's clip 5.
But let me give you just a warning that you won't ever hear much about, but and you almost never hear it, I think. And that is, if you have problems within, all kinds of problems within, race riots, race problems, anarchy, chaos, and all that, it just makes you very vulnerable to these powerful nations outside, other nations of the world. Just consider Russia and China and radical Islam are just gobbling up the territory of their neighbors, even as I speak. You think they wouldn't attack America if we were weak and divided and hating each other and tearing each other apart? You think they wouldn't? I tell you, history cries aloud that they absolutely would. And we've already, Winston Churchill said, look, the history of man is the history of war. We've already had two world wars. You think people wouldn't love to destroy a superpower that is many people? Well, we need to learn a lesson. We need to learn it quickly.
That's my father from 2015. It's a warning that you don't hear. Certainly not often enough. How vulnerable is the United States with this kind of internal sickness and disease? I mean, that exposes us to the grave dangers abroad. He mentioned that, too, in 2011, clip 8.
You see, the gravest danger is not from the enemies without. It's from bitter division from within.
Well, the division within gets it all started. And that fits right in with Isaiah 1 and Ezekiel 5. The gravest danger, Lincoln also talked about that, the final bit from this article, Spectator, it says, if America is to come together again, it will do so only through the restoration of what Lincoln called our mystic cords of memory, a common culture that emerges from a shared and sympathetic understanding of our past, the sort of shared understanding that can bring a Union and a Confederate officer to a wedding, and former Union General George Armstrong Custer, alias Marshall Armstrong, to the rescue. The common culture, the shared and sympathetic understanding of our past. We've got to get back to our history. We've got to get back to the foundations. The foundation of the country. That's what he's saying. God said to spiritual Israel in this end time that you've got to remember. Otherwise, you're going to leave yourself open for attack from the devil. And that's what happened to so many in God's church. They forgot their history. They forgot all about it. And that's what we're doing in the United States and in Great Britain as well. Both of these nations of Israel. Isaiah 1 and verse 5 talks about the whole head being sick and the whole heart faint. There's just no health, vibrance, and vitality. There's a little bit of a resurgence economically and in some other areas, as I said at the top. But what about these root causes of division and strife? Are they being healed and fixed? Isaiah said, from the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Your country, Isaiah says, is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. I mean, your cities are going to go up in flames if you keep up with this. It's a terrifying passage. But this is all because of sin. There's sickness from head to toe. We're just laden down with it. When evil prospers, when sin prospers, It leads to destruction. Verse 9 says, except the Eternal of Hosts had left unto us a small, very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. That's what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. Universal sin brings about universal destruction. Mr. Armstrong makes this point in Incredible Human Potential. God says, hear, hear the word of the Eternal, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. I mean, God's just disgusted with the sinful living that we're all guilty of. Both sides, all sides. Well, you look at that prophecy in Ezekiel 4 and 5, the coming economic siege, the economic prosperity. It's not going to go on for much longer in the United States. A siege is coming, and when that sets in, when it becomes a struggle financially, then you're going to really see people taking to the streets and screaming, screaming at the opposition, screaming at who they see as the enemy. Ezekiel 5:1, it says, and you, son of man, take you a sharp knife, take you a barber's razor, and cause it to pass upon your head and upon your beard, and take the balances to weigh and divide the hair. You shall burn with fire a third part in the midst of the city. This is what happens in the cities. When the days of the siege are fulfilled, and you shall take a third part and smite about it with a knife, and a third part you shall scatter into the wind, and I'll draw out a sword after them. So the first third is to burn with fire, as it says in Ezekiel 5. And then the second third, that comes as a result of the attack from without. And then the final third, finally, scattered into slavery all over the world. Well, Herbert Armstrong talked about the coming economic siege. But you put that together with the civil unrest, the hatred that you see, the division, the next civil war, it's going to be worse, far worse than the one in the 1860s. A third part shall die with the pestilence, it says in verse 12. Well, we've gotten into that before. But God is against us, as this same passage brings out. God is against us. My father writes in the Ezekiel booklet, the seeds of this future calamity have already been sown. That's the thing. That's the significance here. You can see it. You can see it in some, like in this the case of this spectator author, this historian. He can see where this is leading. I mean, we're just erasing our own history or condemning it, saying that they were this or they were that. The seeds have been planted. The seeds, they're there. The government has lost control. There's a breakdown of law and order. When the riots in Baltimore were at their peak, this is from the Ezekiel booklet. He's commenting on all the unrest, the racial hatred during, what was it, 2014-15, those last years of the Obama administration. It says, when the riots in Baltimore were at their peak, the mayor instructed the police to stand down and to give protesters space. And we're going to see that happen again. Space to destroy. Just let it run its course. Let the tantrum run its course. And this is particularly dangerous when you consider that Satan and his demons are confined to this earth, like Hebrew, or rather Revelation 12 brings out. As my father said, we're getting dangerously close to social anarchy and chaos. An excellent article there at the American Spectator. The next civil war will be worse than our last. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. the Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
I've mentioned a couple of times this week about the PYC program, just how active it is. Mr. Armstrong, I've referred to that article from 1967 where he talked about the young people. They're kept so busy in all of these enjoyable activities, in hearing lectures, swimming, canoeing, that sort of thing, that there's just no time for mischief, moral or otherwise. They keep busy up until the end of the day. And then when they get back to the dorm or the tent or wherever they're staying, they get right on to resting. They go right to sleep. Well, I mentioned this article yesterday. I didn't bring it down with me, but I did today. This is from studyfinds.org. And it's showing just how much young people in the UK aren't interested in going outside. They want to stay inside. And you know why? Because they're playing with some gadget. The survey found that 40% of parents have to force their video gaming children to leave the house. They have to force them out. They have to force them outside. The average child, this is between the ages of 6 and 16, I believe, spends just 7 hours a week outside, but more than twice that playing video games. So 7 hours a week outside, 15 or so hours playing video games. The average child spends, on average, about an hour a day outside. This is from the study. Today's children and teens, the survey found, prefer a whole host of activities over playing in the mud. These activities include gaming, watching TV, surfing the web, and listening to music. All of them, inactive. I mean, you can be as inert as a stop sign and do all of those activities. They'd rather do that, though, than go outside. It says, with games such as Fortnite, not familiar with that, it says, taking over the lives of many young children. Can you imagine? A video game, Fortnite, whatever that is, taking over the life of your child. Well, it's common in the UK. This is common for British children between the ages of 6 and 16 to sit around and, as I said last Friday, to stare at a screen. Taking over the lives of many young children. They'd prefer to stay indoors than kick a football around with friends or wander through the woods. Here's some more shockers, as it says here. 4 in 10 British adolescents have never gone camping. Nearly half have never built a den or a fort. And more than half have never climbed a tree. Isn't that sad? Many who have tried these rites of passage couldn't stop thinking about their devices. They haven't even climbed a tree. A six-year-old. Imagine a six-year-old in the world today. It's so common, though. This is common. They've never climbed a tree. They've never built a fort. They don't go outside. They don't kick the ball around. They don't play games. Outdoor, active games, I mean. It's just all on the screen. I mean, some of the laugh-out-loud moments of that first volume of Manchester's on Winston Churchill were those sections describing the way he was as a youth. I mean, you don't picture him, you know, as especially active physically when he was in his 50s and 60s, but he sure was active mentally by that point. But when he was young, I mean, he had the combination, the physical and the mental activity. The theme for this camp, as I said the other day, is action this day. Action this day. Take action. That's the real shame here, is these youths, these young people in the world today, I mean, they're not in the habit of living active lives. And do the parents think that Fortnite or television or a smartphone is going to motivate them to make something of their lives? To get them excited about a life of action? Manchester said, regarding Churchill, away from his desk, he was active at his desk, but away from his desk, he was at various times an airplane pilot, an artist, a farmer, a fencer, a hunter, a breeder of racehorses, a polo player, a collector of tropical fish, and a shooter of wild animals in Africa. That was just a youth from the 1800s. History that we've long since forgotten, just like I said in the first segment. You talk about taking action. Churchill was used to doing that. Macmillan, a commentator of his day, Churchill's day, said, I read this the other day. Well, I can just paraphrase, but he described Chartwell as just a place that was beaming with power and energy, and there was just this nonstop flow of action. And he said, this is in the 1930s when he didn't even hold a political office. He was just in the House of Commons. He wasn't a member of the government. And yet, as someone commented, Churchill alone seemed to be in command of his Chartwell estate, where he was gathering all of this intelligence, and everyone else seemed dazed and confused. Everyone else was hesitating while Churchill was acting. He was a man of action, if ever there was one. He was a man of action. Action this day, even in looking at the things he liked to write about. This, too, is brought out in the first volume, Visions of Glory. Manchester says more than half of the 56 books that Churchill published were about war and warriors. The two that he most regretted not having found time to write were biographies of Caesar and Napoleon. Why did he write so much about war and warriors? Well, Manchester says partly this was because he knew that peace has not her heroes. There's no heroes to write about in peaceful times. And he meant to be heroic. He says it was also in part because of his combative spirit. He agreed with George Meredith. This is quoting Meredith, it is a terrific decree in life that they must act who would prevail. Those who prevail are men and women of action. That's how important this is. I mean, what a powerful concept. You see the devil behind the movement today to get our children, to get all of us, really, to where we just sit down in front of the screen. That's our routine. But like I quoted the other day from Einstein, nothing happens until something moves. You're not going to accomplish anything of purpose, anything significant, unless there's some kind of action. Every successful venture flows from action of some kind. Churchill, as I said on Wednesday, he was more concerned about inaction. than he was about action. Halfway measures are more dangerous than none, too, he said. So if you're going to act, do it wholeheartedly. Ecclesiastes brings that out. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Don't be halfway about it. You know, a similar point can be made when you just look at the peak of the British Empire, when it was at its absolute highest power point, the peak of its power. It says here, under Victoria, one regiment, this is also from Manchester's Visions of Glory, that's Queen Victoria, it means. Under Victoria, one regiment or another had been in action every year, somewhere on five continents, fighting from Aden and Afghanistan to Zululand and the Zor Valley. They were almost always victorious. One reason was their sublime, unfathomable courage. An astonishing number actually enjoyed courting death. It wasn't just Churchill going to India or going to Egypt or going to South Africa courting death. This was the English way. This was the way for young Englishmen back in the late 1800s. There's a point to be made there about their unfathomable courage, but look at the action of the British Empire. During the Queen Victoria days, I mean, they had a regiment, some kind of regiment or another, in action everywhere, somewhere on earth. I mean, when the British Empire was taking action, when it was on the move, when it was on the offensive, the empire expanded its territory and its power and its influence and its reach. There's a lesson that we can draw from this. Churchill was a man of empire, as my father's brought out before. And that's what made him such a successful leader. I mean, sadly, he had to watch and in some ways even preside over the demise of empire. This is from Visions of Glory as well. This is quoting Churchill's first political address, 1897. So when was he born? 1874, I think. So he's 22 or 23 years of age here. Imagine a 23-year-old today. No offense to you, Sam. You could deliver something like this. But there's not that many that could pull this off. Not that many young people that could put together a speech like this. He said in 1897, "There are not wanting those who say that in this jubilee year of our empire, that it's reached the height of its glory and power, and that we should now begin to decline as Babylon, Carthage, and Rome declined. Do not believe these croakers." Do not believe these croakers. But give the lie to their dismal croaking by showing by our actions that the vigor and vitality of our race is unimpaired and that our determination is to uphold the empire that we have inherited from our fathers as Englishmen. We have inherited this empire from our fathers. We're not going to let it slip away. We're not just going to throw this to the wind. We're not going down without a fight. That's what he said in 1897. I mean, no wonder he did what he did in 1940. He had that same action-oriented spirit when he was an old man as well. Stayed right with him all the way through. He said in that same speech, then shall we continue to pursue that course marked out for us by an all-wise hand. You see, God was involved. God's hand is clearly evident. Said the man that many want to now say, oh, well, he was just agnostic. He didn't believe. Well, he certainly was ambivalent, at least, when it came to the power of God. Now, he certainly was not a religious man in the sense that we understand that to mean today. He didn't go to Sunday services and such, but he read the Bible, and he certainly was aware of the strong hand of God, as he told the U.S. Congress. Of course there's a strong hand. I mean, you'd be a blind soul to not see that there's some great purpose being worked out here below. He said in this speech as a 23-year-old, then shall we continue to pursue that course marked out for us by an all-wise hand and carry out our mission of bearing peace, civilization, and good government to the utmost ends of the earth. He was no little Englander by any means. He was a man of vision. He was a man of action. And this is the spirit that we want to cultivate in God's church. It's the spirit we want to cultivate at God's youth camps. He took it right with him into Britain's darkest hour in confronting that man, that wicked man. I read the quote to you on Wednesday when he was there in the House of Commons after it was obvious, it was painfully obvious, that he was right about Germany rearming. And he said, look, we could have stopped this before it even got started if we were just willing to take action. Simple, effective action. We could have stopped all of it. That's me. I'm shaking the podium. Sorry. Sam's looking around at what's causing the interference here. But if we would have been willing to take action, he said, simple and effective, we could have stopped this. Manchester said about Churchill that he loved risks and he always sought for ways to carry the war to the enemy. He always looked for ways to go on the offensive. Action this day. There's an interesting section at the end of volume 2 where it talks about some of the men of Munich and how that they were waiting for this. And then the leaders in France and in early 1940, Germany, of course, is on the march. Germany devoured Poland. Everybody knew they were coming next for France, for Belgium, the Netherlands, all of those nations in Western Europe. And it talks about these leaders saying that, well, we'll prepare this and we're not quite ready to confront him. And so we're kind of planning it for February. All right, well, let's just get through the winter and then we can fight. Or let's just wait through the summer and then we can fight. And what they needed was what they finally got in Britain on May 10th, 1940. Someone who was willing to take action this day. To take the fight to the enemy today, not tomorrow, not next month, not next summer. You can see how powerful this concept is when you understand what we're to do spiritually. To be doers of the word, to be a doer of God's word, that takes action. That takes action this day. My father in The Overcomer booklet talks about going on the offensive. There's a whole chapter in there devoted to that concept. Mr. Armstrong is another perfect example of someone who took action. And it started in the days of his youth. You can read about it in the autobiography. He was very active, particularly after the age of 16. Very active. A lot of similarities between him and Winston Churchill. At the age of 16, that's when he had that spark of ambition. This is how he described it in a sermon from the 80s. This is clip one.
And he kept telling me this kind of thing and encouraging me, and somehow he aroused ambition in me. And I came to realize that ambition was just two things. Of course, it's a desire to succeed and to have, but also it is the resolution to work and to produce that desired result. And it doesn't come easy, and I knew that.
That's Mr. Armstrong talking about the hotel manager in Altoona, Iowa, back when he was 16 years of age, right there in the early 1900s. This man kept telling Mr. Armstrong that he could be something. He could do something with his life. And that, as he said there, aroused ambition in him. And ambition is more than the desire, as he explained. I mean, it's the resolution to work and to produce. The resolution to take action. He took action. He said in his autobiography, "It's impossible to estimate the importance of this sudden arousal of ambition, this injection of an intense desire for success, this igniting of the spark of determined energy to achieve worthy accomplishment. This was the turning point of my life." This was the turning point of his life. And as he went on to explain in his autobiography, I mean, this is the vital ingredient that's missing from most human beings today, certainly from most young people. They don't have this ambition, this resolution to work and to produce. But once he got it, I mean, he started working and he never stopped. The drive, the determination to serve God, to give to God. Here again, he was a man of action. And that action, of course, it includes more than physical activity. It's, like I say, going back to the PYC program, you've got the balance between the physical activity and the mental activity. And whether it was Herbert Armstrong or Winston Churchill, in either direction, I mean, they really went after it, physically and mentally. Here's another clip from that same message, clip two.
An education consists of study, it consists of thinking, it consists of mixing minds with other people, it consists of travel, it consists of observation and thinking and action. And so I decided that I had the ambition and the desire to work, and I would get my education in that way.
He did it himself, much like Churchill did. Autodidact. It's the word you see a few times in Manchester's work. Self-taught. Well, in the case of Mr. Armstrong, there was another being very much involved. And so, too, with Winston Churchill. We know that from the Ezekiel booklet. But education, it comes from study, as he said there. From observation. From mixing minds with other people. And from action. And he explained in the autobiography that the reason you have to have schools and colleges is that most people are too lazy to push themselves. They're too lazy to take action. And so they need to go to the school where the program is there for them. And it's nothing against the schools. I mean, we have them. We need them. They're excellent places of training for our young people. But education doesn't stop once you receive the degree or the diploma. It continues right on. And hopefully, if you have 2 or 4 years at God's college, you come to that opportunity. And by the time it's over, you are in the well-established habit of taking action. Taking action mentally, physically, spiritually. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong said. This is actually from an old radio show. This is clip three.
You know, some time back, I found several students here at Ambassador College just floundering around. Their grades were going down. Professors began to report it to me. But I found the reason. When I talked to these students, they had no objective. There was no purpose. You know, if you're not interested in what you're doing, you're not going to do it well. If you have a goal, then you're interested in what you're doing. You know where you're going, and you want to keep on till you get there. Yes, first in order of the 7 rules of success is to have a right goal in life. Not any goal, the right goal. Aim in life that will inspire ambition, that will move you on to success. I remember one girl we had that had a goal before she came to Ambassador College, and we found she was bogging down here. She didn't have any goal. She said her goal had been accomplished. The only goal in life she had was to get to come to Ambassador College. Now she was here, her goal was accomplished. Well, we had to show her a bigger goal ahead. It's going to take her the rest of her life to find it. I think she's on her way now.
That's a great clip there from one of his old radio shows. How big are our goals? I mean, I had a daughter just leave for college this week, and that would be a great quote for her to listen to for all of our incoming students. The goal is not to just get to the school. And even at the graduation, I mean, it's commencement time. I mean, it's the beginning. We need bigger goals. We need epic goals. All of us, spiritually, physically. Otherwise, we begin to bog down, just like he described there. Another clip. Here's number four.
Most young men never think about having a goal. They never think about what are they going to do when they grow up. They never think about what kind of work are they going to do, what kind of occupation or what kind of profession will they get into.
They just don't even consider it. They're too busy playing Fortnite. They're not outside. They're not building things. They're not playing sports. They're not into praying and studying. They're not into bettering themselves. I mean, it all starts with the mind, really. Colossians 3, 1 and 2, we've got to set our minds on things above. We've got to have big goals spiritually. And then what comes out from that, what flows out from that mindset, from that thinking, is a life of action. Mr. Armstrong, in the autobiography, he talked about learning the rules of success. He later wrote a booklet, The 7 Laws of Success. Those clips I just played for you talked about the first law. You've got to fix that goal, that right goal. Whether it's your future job or whether it's your aim to get into God's kingdom, you've got long-term, middle-term, and short-term goals. But we've got to clearly identify those goals so that we know what we're aiming for. That's the first law of success. And then the second rule, as he explains, is education. And Mr. Armstrong, he felt like he had the motivation. He had the determination to be educated himself and from his Uncle Frank. I mean, rather than go to a university. And so he did do that. And God then broadened his education later when he got into God's Word, the Bible. The third rule of success is good, vigorous physical health. Physical health, so that we have the energy, so that we can bring energy to our daily routine, so that we'll be able to drive ourselves. That's the fourth rule, to really put the prod on ourselves, to act. With Mr. Armstrong, there was always this sense of urgency, and Winston Churchill said the same thing. I mentioned that the other day, where he got into his 20s. And he lamented the fact that his life was going by so fast. He had to hurry because there was so much yet to do. Drive. And then resourcefulness. As he says in the autobiography, thinking about the problem at hand. For example, he writes, the experience of the goat work job and then in finding a way to get in room for rent ads faster by telephone was an example of learning this rule by experience. Thinking through and applying initiative to a better way of solving a problem and then to stick with it. That's the sixth rule. Perseverance. Never quitting. Even when it appears like everything else has fallen apart or everyone else has given up. And then finally, the seventh and final and most important law, the rule of success, is contact with God. Contact with our Maker. Break that booklet out for you and your children. Pull it off the shelf and go through those 7 laws because, as you'll notice, in breaking them down one by one, all 7 laws, all 7 rules are action steps. They're all action steps. You have to take action. to clearly outline your goals. You have to take action if you're going to educate yourself, if you're going to be in good, vigorous health. It takes action to drive yourself, to find a way to be resourceful and to stick with it. And through it all, to make sure that God is right at the center, that God is inspiring you, that God is leading you, that God is teaching you. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. All the other things will be added. Remember how important it is to act if you're going to accomplish anything worthwhile. Remember how important it is to act when it comes to overcoming and conquering the devil, conquering an enemy, going on the offensive. That's an action-oriented strategy. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.